I am thinking, rather, of the old Buddhist metaphor of the doctor in which is like a raft for crossing a river. When you have reached the opposite shore, you do not carry the raft on your back, but leave it behind. There is something here which applies not only to the mere handful of people who might be said to have reached the opposite shore, but to most of us. To carry out the metaphor a little, if you are going to cross the river, you must make haste, for if you dally on the raft, the current will carry you downstream and out to the ocean, and then you will be stuck on the raft forever. And it is so easy to get stuck on the raft, on religion, on psychotherapy, on philosophy. To use another Buddhist simile, the doctrine is like a finger pointing at the moon, and one must take care not to mistake the finger for the moon. Too many of us, I fear, suck the pointing finger of religion for comfort instead of looking where it points. Now, it seems to me that what the finger of religion points at is something not at all religious. Religion, with all its apparatus of ideas and practices, is altogether a pointing, and it does not point at itself. It doesn't point at God either, for the notion of God is part and parcel of religion. I might say that what religion points at is reality, except that this merely puts a philosophical notion in place of a religious one. And I can think of a dozen other substitutes for God, or reality. I could say that it points to one's true self, at the eternal now, at the nonverbal world, at the infinite and ineffable. But really, none of this is very helpful. It's just putting one finger in place of another. When Joshua asked his teacher, Nansen, "What is the Tao, the way?" Nansen replied, "Your everyday mind is the Tao." But this doesn't help either. For as soon as I try to understand what is meant by my everyday mind, and then try to latch on to it, I am just sucking another finger. But why does this difficulty arise? If someone actually points his finger at the moon, I have no difficulty in turning and looking at the moon. But the thing at which these religious and philosophical fingers are pointing seems to be invisible, so that when I turn to look, there is nothing there, and I am forced to go back to the finger to see whether I understood its direction correctly. And, sure enough, I find time and time again that I made no mistake about its direction, but, for all this, I simply cannot see what it's pointing at. All this is equally exasperating for the person who is doing the pointing, for he wants to show me something which to him is so obvious that one would think any fool could see it. He must feel as we all feel when trying to explain to a thick-headed child that 2 times 0 is 0 and not 2, or some other perfectly simple little fact. And there is something even more exasperating than this. I am sure that many of you may, for a fleeting moment, have had one clear glimpse of what the finger was pointing at, a glimpse in which you shared the pointer's astonishment that you had never seen it before, in which you saw the whole thing so plainly that you knew you could never forget it, and then you lost it. After this, there may be a tormenting nostalgia that goes on for years. How to find the way back to the door in the wall that no longer seems to be there, back to the turning which led into paradise, which wasn't on the map, which you saw for sure right here, but now there is nothing. It is like trying to trace someone with whom you fell in love at first sight and then lost touch, and you go back to the original place of meeting again and again, trying in vain to pick up the threads. If I may put it in a way which is horribly cumbersome and inadequate, that fleeting glimpse is the perception that, suddenly, some very ordinary moment of your ordinary everyday life, lived by your very ordinary self, just as it is and just as you are, that this immediate here and now is perfect and self-sufficient beyond any possibility of description. You know that there is nothing to desire or seek for, that no techniques, no spiritual apparatus or belief or discipline is necessary, no system of philosophy or religion. The goal is here. It is this present experience, just as it is. That, obviously, is what the finger was pointing at. But the next moment, as you look again, the instant in which you are living is as ordinary as ever, though the finger still points right at it. However, this irritatingly elusive quality of the vision to which the finger points has an extremely simple explanation, an explanation which has to do with what I said at the beginning about getting rid of the raft when you have crossed the river, about taking religion as a medicine, not as a diet. For purposes of understanding this point, we must take the raft as representing the ideas or words or other symbols whereby a religion or a philosophy expresses itself, whereby it points at the moon of reality. As soon as you have understood the words in their plain and straightforward sense, you have already used the raft. You have reached the opposite bank of the river. All that remains now is to do what the words say, to drop the raft and go walking on the dry land. And to do this, you must drop the raft. In other words, you cannot, at this stage, think about religion and practice it at the same time. To see the moon, you must forget the pointing finger and simply look at the moon. This is why all the great Asian philosophers begin with the practice of concentration, that is, of attentive looking. It is as if to say, if you want to know what reality is, you must look directly at it and see for yourself. But this needs a certain kind of concentration, because reality is not symbols. It is not words and thoughts. It is not reflections and fantasies. Therefore, to see it clearly, your mind must be free from wandering words and from the floating fantasies of memory. To this, we are probably apt to reply, "Fine, but this is easier said than done." There always seems to be a problem about translating words into action, and this problem seems to be peculiarly acute when it comes to the so-called spiritual life. Faced with this problem, we back up and start to busy ourselves with a lot of discussion about methods, techniques, and other aids to concentration. But it should be simple enough to see that this is nothing but procrastination and postponement. You cannot, at the same time, concentrate and think about concentrating. It sounds almost silly to say it, but the only way to concentrate is to concentrate. In actually doing it, the idea of doing it disappears. And this is the same thing as saying that religion disappears when it becomes real and effective. Now, a great deal of the talk about the difficulty of action or the difficulty of concentration is sheer nonsense. If we are sitting down together at a meal and I say to you, "Please pass the salt," you just do it, and there is no difficulty about it. You do not stop to consider the right method. You do not trouble yourself with the problem of how. When you have picked the salt shaker up, you are going to be able to concentrate on it long enough to bring it to my end of the table. Now, there is absolutely no difference between this and concentrating the mind's attention to see into the nature of reality. If you can concentrate the mind for 2 seconds, you can do it for 2 minutes. And if you can do it for 2 minutes, you can do it for 2 hours. Of course, if you want to make this kind of thing horribly difficult, you begin to think about timing yourself. Instead of concentrating, you begin to think about whether you are concentrating, about how long you have concentrated, and about how much longer you are going to keep it up. All of this is totally off the point. Concentrate for 1 second. If, at the end of this time, your mind has wandered off, concentrate for another second, and then another. Nobody ever has to concentrate for more than 1 second. This one. This is why it is quite literally off the point to time yourself, to compete with yourself, and to bother about your progress and success in the art. It's simply the old story of making a difficult job easy by taking it one step at a time. There is, perhaps, another difficulty. And this is that in the state of concentration, of clear, unwavering attention, one has no self. That is, no self-consciousness. This is because the so-called self is a construct of words and memories, of fantasies which have no existence in immediate reality. The block or stoppage, which so many of us feel between words and action, between symbol and reality, is actually a case of wanting to have one's cake and eat it. We want to enjoy ourselves and fear that if we forget ourselves, there will be no enjoyment. An entertainment without anyone present to be entertained. This is why self-consciousness is a constant inhibition of creative action, a kind of chronic self-frustration, such that civilizations which suffer from an overdose of it go raving mad, invent atom bombs, and blow themselves up. Self-consciousness is a stoppage, because it is like interrupting a song after every note so as to listen to the echo, and then feeling irritated because of the loss of rhythm. This is all really a case of our own proverb, "A watched pot never boils," for if you try to watch your mind concentrate, it will not concentrate, and if, when it is concentrated, you begin to watch for the arrival of some insight into reality, you have stopped concentrating. Real concentration is therefore a rather curious and seemingly paradoxical state, since it is at once the maximum of consciousness and the minimum of ego feeling, which somewhat gives the lie to those systems of Western psychology which identify the conscious principle with the ego. Similarly, it is the maximum of mental activity or efficiency and the minimum of mental purposiveness, since one cannot simultaneously concentrate and expect a result from concentration. The only way to enter into this state is precipitately, without delay or hesitation, just do it. This is why I ordinarily avoid discussion of all the various kinds of Asian meditation techniques, such as yoga. For I am inclined to feel that for most Westerners, these are not aids but obstacles to concentration. It is not unaffected and natural for us to assume the lotus posture and go through all sorts of spiritual gymnastics. So many Westerners who do this kind of thing are so self-conscious about it, so preoccupied with the idea of doing it, that they never really do it at all. For the same reason, I am rather leery of too much Zen, especially when it means importing all the purely incidental apparatus of Zen from Japan, all the strictly technical formalities, and all the endless and pointless discussions about who has or hasn't attained Sartori, or about how many koans one has solved, or how many hours a day one sits in Zazen or meditation. This sort of thing is not Zen or yoga. It is just a fad, just religiosity, and is precisely self-consciousness and affectation rather than unself-consciousness and naturalness. If, however, you can really do the thing itself, that is, if you can learn to wake up and concentrate at the drop of a hat, you can take or leave the trimmings as you will. For the fear of exoticism should not prevent us from enjoying the really beautiful things which Asian culture has to offer. Chinese painting, Japanese architecture, Indian philosophy, and all the rest. But the point is that we cannot really enter into the spirit of these things at all unless, in the first place, we can acquire the special kind of relaxed concentration and clear-sightedness which is essential for their proper appreciation. Of themselves, they will not give us that capacity, which is something innate. If you have to import it from Asia, you do not have it at all. Therefore, the important thing is simply to begin, anywhere, wherever you are. If you happen to be sitting, just sit. If you are smoking a pipe, just smoke it. If you are thinking out a problem, just think. But don't think and reflect unnecessarily, compulsively, from sheer force of nervous habit. In Zen, they call this having a leaky mind, like an old barrel with open seams which cannot contain itself. Well, I think this is enough medicine for tonight. Let's put the bottle away and go out and look at the moon. Importance. Buddhism is often accused of being a religion so absorbed in the impersonal and the eternal that it overlooks the importance of individual and temporal things. According to its teachings, all things that have form are subject to change and void of any enduring self. But this does not imply that such things are unimportant. Importance is not measured by time, and change is a symptom of the presence of life. A Japanese poem says, "The morning glory blooms for an hour, yet it differs not at heart from the giant pine which lives 1,000 years. Beside the immensity of time and space, man seems a being of the most utter insignificance. In comparison with the vastly complicated problems of the modern world, the lesser hopes and fears of the individual seem of no consequence. But Buddhism is the middle way, and must necessarily regard such an extreme attitude as false philosophy. It is well that one who is too much concerned with his own affairs should consider the immensity of the universe and the destiny of the human race. But let him not consider it too long, lest he forget that the responsibility not only for human prosperity, but also for the order of the universe, is his own." While modern astronomy tells us of our insignificance beneath the stars, it also tells us that if we lift so much as a finger, we affect them. It is true that we are transient, that we have no abiding self, but the fabric of life is such that one broken thread may work immeasurable ruin. The magnitude of the world, with whose destiny we are bound up, increases rather than diminishes our importance. Nature may seem to have little regard for individuals,